Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 247 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and as always, I'm joined by two co-hosts. The first is David Vanderhoof, our aviation historian from the What Just Flew By blog.
Hey, Max. Had a great weekend. Got to go out to the Air Force Museum. Had a lovely time. It was Space Fest, so I got to see their new shuttle training orbiter. And I also did get an interview from the director, public affairs director, NASA Glenn facility, as well as an invitation to possibly go out there for a weekend.
Wow.
We did a little work for Airplane Geeks, but basically it is impressive to go to a museum where they have a B-36 sitting next to a B-52, sitting next to B-47s. We had taken my friend's 18-year-old son, who'd never been there before, out with us. And it was kind of nice to see wide-eyed joy as he was just didn't realize how big that museum actually is.
As we've said before, anyone who's anywhere near Dayton, Ohio, should certainly make the effort to stop in and see that, because it's quite an impressive museum.
8 hours, 650 miles each way. It's not a bad trip.
All right. Well, our other co-host is Rob Mark. He's our pilot of the bunch, and he's from the Jetwine blog.
And I wouldn't drive 650 miles for almost anything.
Would you drive 650 miles to see David or I?
I guess I would, because you guys, to sound like Dan, oh yeah, because you guys are so special.
All right, well, we're glad to hear that.
That's my Dan imitation.
Yeah, okay.
I guess the question we really would need to ask him would be, would he drive that far to see Mary?
In fact, I'm already on my way. Certainly I would. And did we figure out who that lady was that made the comment about the fact that I need to, chill out?
Calm down. Yeah, I think we did. We'll mention that when we get to the listener mail.
Okay.
But before that, we've got a couple of things to do. First of all, we want to introduce our guest this episode. He's Arthur Rosen. Now, let me mention just a few things about Arthur. Arthur writes the blog My Opinion, Thoughts and Comments on General Aviation. He's also the Airport Support Network volunteer for the Scottsdale Airport. He's past chairman of the Scottsdale Airport Advisory Commission, and he's even served on the Super Bowl Committee for Aviation. That sounds interesting. He's past president of the Arizona Soaring Association. He writes for Plane and Pilot News, and sometimes he shows up on the ABC TV affiliate in Phoenix. And if that's all not enough, he's also a retired judge. So, Arthur, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Good evening, Max. Good evening, geeks. Really happy to be here this evening.
Well, wait, I object.
Oh, it's starting already.
But I'm not sure what I'm objecting to. I just always wanted to say that to a judge. But
that's okay. I understand you're objectionable, but I'm really looking forward to tonight's show.
Oh, I see. Oh, we have a humorous judge. Oh, this is going to be fun.
It's going to be good.
Hey, Rob, you have the right to remain silent. Anything you can say and will be used against you later.
All right. So we can get all the judge jokes out of the way at the start. Okay. Let's see. Arthur, what is an Airport Support Network volunteer? What is that all about?
Phil Boyer, when he was president of AOPA, felt like he needed local eyes and ears of local pilots to let AOPA National know what's going on at different airports and what the problems are.
Yeah.
So he put together a very well-planned program, now currently run by Joey Collarin, before it was run by Stacy Zweigert, who's now with the FAA in Washington, D.C. And these people are the eyes and the ears of the airports across the country.
That's fascinating. How long have you been in that role?
Well, it's been a long time, and actually I did Phoenix Deer Valley first, which is the world's busiest general aviation airport. But a friend of mine became airport manager of Scottsdale, and I'm only a mile and a half down the street from Scottsdale Airport, so I switched over to Scottsdale about 2.5 years ago. So I'd say about 8 years altogether.
Well, certainly we're going to talk with Arthur about a lot of topics coming up. Well, first, though, we've got some aviation news to talk about from the past week. And David, we had a shootout for the aircraft of the week, and I assume the listeners have spoken?
They did, and the winner is the Volte Valiant, one of the aircraft to train thousands of pilots for the United States Army Air Corps and the United States Navy and Marine Corps during World War II.
Okay, good. That sounds fascinating. Also coming up, we have Steve and Grant from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast with their Australia desk report. And Peter Johnson has his Across the Pond segment covering European aviation. We'll look forward to that. And we have some listener mail that we've received in the past week. And so we'll spend a little bit of time going over some of that. First, though, let's get started with the aviation news. Is everyone ready?
Ready.
Our first story comes from AIN Online. This is Business Aviation Safety Seminar. Used properly, copious collected data enhances safety. Now, I ran across this article a few days ago and found it really kind of fascinating and thought this would be a good article to talk about on the show. And only after that did I realize that this thing was written by our very own Rob Mark.
You realize nobody's going to believe that.
It's true. I'm not favoring Rob. No one should think that I'm playing favorites here. But anyway, the Flight Safety Foundation, they held the 58th Safety Seminar for Business Aviation in Montreal, and it focused on training and fatigue management and data sharing as a safety management tool. Let's focus first maybe on training. Rob and Arthur, do we really have training standards, or is every CFI out there, every school that offers training, kind of doing their own thing?
Well, if you're talking about Part 61, which are essentially freelance instructors or people that are not required to adhere to a particular FAA-approved curriculum, you could say that. But of course, the end result is all the same. You need to get everybody ready for the same flight test that's prescribed in the PTS, the practical test standard. So however you do that, some instructors may better prepare their students than others. And but I think the issue with training that we were talking about up in Montreal was on a number of things that the business aviation people are taking for granted. Like safety management systems, which is the buzzword in the aviation industry now. The airlines have had them for a while, and the concept is great. Hey, when you screw something up, everybody talks about it, and they try to understand what caused the problem and hopefully prevent the same kind of problem from occurring again. It's just that, of course, when people start to regulate it, as FAA's in the process of doing, it tends to become a little complicated. And that's part of what they were talking about, at least on that aspect of the training. But then there is, of course, the other aspect of flight training, which is how prepared are professional pilots to cope with the unknown?
I have a problem with the training of professional pilots, especially for the airlines. As you know now, the requirement is going to be 1,500 hours in an ATP for FO.
Right.
The problem I have is back in Air Force days, you go on the simulator and you take your check ride. And you'd get through with your check ride and the instructor would say, now, is there anything you want to do? You got your ticket, nothing's being held against you. When you're an airline pilot, you go in the simulator and all you want to do is get out of there with your ticket. You don't want to do anything extra because they'll hold it against you. I feel that the training is totally wrong, and no offense to CFIs, CFIIs, but they fly in circle for hours to build up their hours and do not have real-world experience. Pilots need, and we know that the second part of the problem is there's no sim time available. Those sims run 24/7. I really believe we need to put people in simulators and have them train for every type of incident that might be out there. They're not getting the real world experience when they fly. As flight instructors, they don't know how to deal with weather. They don't know how to deal with heavy sectors like Los Angeles and San Diego, being from this side of the country. So I have a real problem with the training we're doing to get people ready for the airlines.
If you're a pilot, where do you go for simulator time?
Okay, when I talk simulator time, I'm talking mainly people who are getting ready to fly for the airlines and some commercial. Business aviation, but as a private pilot like myself that flies piston aircraft, you're not going to get the simulator time. You're going to have to do it at a flight academy, a flight school, or a university.
Can you just go buy time? I mean, can you just say, sell me 3 hours of sim time and work to improve your own proficiency and skills, or does it not work that way?
No, it doesn't work that way. You've got to be part of a program. And even the people who are training for the airlines don't have enough sim time. They don't get enough real-world experience. They're being taught how to fly through situations from single-engine to multi-engine to instrument to commercial to flight instructor to CFI without getting enough real-world experience.
Yeah, and I have to agree with that, because one of the problems that we face in this country, not just in aviation education, but in education in general, is that we're teaching kids the test. You know, since, I won't mention the president that was in before the current one that had that great No Child Left Behind program, but, you know, the goal was to raise test scores. And the problem is that in the process of trying to raise test scores, they kind of forgot about, Are these people getting any smarter? And all they cared about were the scores. And we're a lot like that in flight training, because if you can pass the test and you can perform the functions, then you must be okay. And sometimes it doesn't work that way. Hmm. I mean, people may have a minimal amount of experience, and that's it. And someone says, do you have a commercial certificate? You go, yep, okay, great, you're in. And there isn't a really great place anymore for people to build experience the way that they used to. So, yeah, we got a lot of people that, you know, pass the check rides, and they don't have the smarts, as we're going to see in that next piece.
So my question would be, is this something that's changed recently? Is this situation always existed? Or is it something that's sort of a newer phenomenon?
Well, I think, at least for me, and I hate to sound like the old guy, but Arthur, I don't know, maybe I'm older than you, or maybe you're older than me. Who knows? But again, the emphasis on people becoming smarter, becoming better aviators, that seems to have gotten lost somewhere. And to Arthur's point earlier about the pilots, the airline pilots that want to get out of the simulator when they're done, it's not just that they want to get out. They do. The airlines don't want to pay for it. I mean, so if they say, look, your block of time in the 777 simulator time around is going to be 5 hours, and you say, well, gee, I've got some extra time, can I get an extra half hour? They go, no, because there's somebody booked behind you, or they don't want to pay the time.
Huh.
So we're only teaching you what we think you need to know, and don't worry about the rest. And life, unfortunately, doesn't work that way.
So how does this change? Is there some organization or somebody that can say, hey, look, this is something that we need to do differently in the future? Or is it just going to kind of continue the way it is?
Well, you know, they went to scenario-based training about maybe 6 years ago, 7 years ago, which was, rather than teach someone how to perform a stall, let's say, and for those people that may not understand, that's when the wing stops flying, not the engine, how to perform a stall. What they decided to do was to integrate that into real-world flying, that you're in a traffic pattern and you need to make a short approach and tower's trying to rush you, and so that you'd have a practical aspect to some of the things that you're learning. And I'm not so sure it's worked out very well, at least from the people that I know. But of course, too, we're producing many, many, many fewer pilots than we used to. And like I said, I'm not convinced that we're doing a better job now than we used to. And I'm not certain I know exactly what the next step is going to be, but it's going to have to get better.
Well, I'd like to give you one more example, the Culligan crash up in Buffalo. The captain allegedly flunked several check rides, and the FO, being here from Phoenix, I don't believe she ever saw ice in her life. So when they encountered icing, neither one of them knew what to do with it. And this is why I'm saying the only way I can see the airline training of the future work is got to be a lot more simulator and a lot less flying in circles and doing slow flight and lazy eights and turns around a point and much more practical flying.
Now, we just recently saw an example of kind of, I don't know, I would consider it to be unsafe flying. I think a lot of other people did with this Air India flight. Rob, maybe you can sort of recap what happened.
Well, this is going to sound horribly self-serving because I wrote this story as well, but it was just one of those things that I read this after after someone pointed it out to me last week, and I didn't know whether to be insanely angry or to cry or just suck my thumb. I don't know. I mean, it was so frustrating to think that we had two professional pilots that did this. So let's just lay out the story for everybody. This is an Airbus A321, so it's not a small airplane, nearly 170 people on board, en route from Bangkok to, I think it was going to Mumbai. Somewhere in cruise, the first officer left the cockpit, which is not that unusual. I mean, they use the bathroom, they go back for a cup of coffee, that sort of thing goes on. The problem happened when the captain also left the cockpit, and the first officer hadn't come back. And yes, there are only two pilots on board. And what they did is they put two seat monitors in there. It just happened to be two female flight attendants from the cabin, and stuck them in the seats and said, basically, don't touch anything. We'll be back in a while. And they were gone for 40 minutes. And when one of them happened to hit the autopilot by mistake, and I guess the airplane must have jumped or turned or something, the two guys went running back to the cockpit. It wasn't pretty. The two pilots were suspended, as were the two flight attendants. But the real question is, holy smokes, what in the world was going on that these two professional pilots thought it was okay to get up and leave? I mean,
yeah,
you know, it's just beyond me. It really is.
And like you say, it's not unusual for one of them to get up. In that case, it's kind of a good idea to ask someone to come and, you know, sit in the seat just so there's, you know, two people up there in case something should happen to the, you know, to the other pilot. This is crazy, right? To take both pilots out?
You don't do that. Well, and of course, as someone said, there's a story up on Jetwine about that. There's no rule that says you must have two pilots in the cockpit. It doesn't say that. So somehow these two fellows thought somehow they were covering their bases by having somebody in the seat. That the seats needed to be occupied, I believe, is the phrase that's used in the regs. But it's just, you wonder, where did these guys learn to fly? Obviously, they both bought into it, because if the other pilot, the first officer, had his head screwed on straight when he saw the captain come out, he would have said, what are we doing? Yeah. Gotta get back there. Somebody's got to be up there. And he did the same thing. He sat out there as well. So, I mean, I'll tell you one thing. I'll never fly on Air India.
Yeah, I mean, that certainly raises some questions. Is it just these two particular pilots, or is this symptomatic of some, you know, larger failure? I don't understand why they suspended the flight attendants. I mean, if the captain says, go sit here and I'll be back, I mean, don't flight attendants normally, follow the directives from the cockpit?
Well, and that's an interesting point. My guess is they probably suspended them because they're now saying you should have been smart enough to realize that there are orders that the captain can give you that are just stupid, that are just lame brain, and you can't say yes to everything. That's just beyond me why they did that as well. Now, maybe there's a problem going on at Air India. Well, obviously there's a problem there. I guess my question too is that where else have we seen this kind of behavior? People these days tend to want to know exactly what it is they're supposed to do. I've seen this with new employees. I mean, tell me what you want me to do specifically, and then I'll do that. And if you don't tell me I can't do that, then I guess it must be okay. I can do it. And it's just kind of silly. And this is certainly an extreme case. We watched the Northwest guys, 4 or 5 years ago when they missed Minneapolis because they were playing on their laptops. We kind of laughed at it then. Maybe that was a mistake.
Arthur, what do you think? Do you think this is something where the pilots themselves should sort of bear the brunt of the penalty for doing this? Or do you think that there's the airline itself has some responsibility? Any thoughts?
Well, it's all speculation. I don't know if the pilots and the FAs were playing a game or not. The pilots said, okay, we're going to let you fly this leg and we'll sit in the back and relax. Just don't know what happened there, and doubt if we ever will. But I think the FAA, when a flight officer leaves the flight deck, one FAA has to fill that seat. But I've never heard of both pilots leaving the flight deck at the same time. So I think that they'll both probably be gone. But as Rob said, it's an airline I wouldn't want to fly.
Yeah, they've got some public relations work ahead of them, I would suspect.
So just going back to, having had Mary on last week.
Yes.
What kind of a passenger experience do you think that is when you're sitting in the seats and you realize you've got both pilots, one on either side of you, talking about flying or something? And then you say, gee, who's up flying the airplane?
That's right. Yeah.
Talk your way out of that one.
That's right. Yeah, that would bother me. I don't know. Probably most of the passengers, maybe almost all the passengers, weren't really aware of what was going on. I don't know.
Oh no, I don't think they did. In fact, the pieces that I saw said that most of the passengers really had no clue, and that they didn't find anything out until the aircraft had landed, and they read these stories on the wire.
Yeah. Okay, hey, let's move on to our last item. Boeing has been in the news quite a bit in the last week for a variety of different things. There's an interesting article in Motley Fool, which is an investment kind of a site, and they talk about Boeing takes on the Concorde next supersonic jet. And it's interesting because Boeing and NASA have a project going to see if the sonic boom from commercial supersonic airplanes could be reduced. And NASA has a small supersonic wind tunnel, and they're testing small models. NASA's supersonic research project manager says the tests have reduced the sonic boom to what he called, I guess, an acceptable thump, which is kind of interesting. And we've talked about this, that one of the issues with the Concorde was the footprint sort of laid down by the sonic boom, and how as a result of that they couldn't fly supersonic over the U.S. If they can find a way to reduce or minimize the boom, then that might open up a future for supersonic passenger planes. Do you think we'll ever see that?
Well, I'll speak in here that I know that also Gulfstream, from the business aviation side, is working on supersonic aviation jet for commercial. So for general aviation, business aviation, I think it's going to happen. I don't know when, but I think it'll happen.
Yeah, there are a couple of other folks looking at that. I know Aireon Corporation is working on, a 12-passenger supersonic plane. Their target, I think, is around 2020. So, yeah, these things are not right around the corner.
But they really want one that'll fly across the domestic airspace.
Yes,
that's really what they're after.
That's got to be the goal. That's
because otherwise, it's just not versatile enough. I'm not saying they wouldn't use it flying, say, San Francisco to Hawaii or to the Orient or South America or whatever, but who wants an airplane you can only fly in certain places?
Yeah, that's limiting the business model to a significant degree. Well, talking about going fast, talking about going really, really fast, Aviation Week has an article, X-51A Wave Rider achieves hypersonic goal on final flight. Now, this X-51A Wave Rider, it's a joint program between Boeing, the Air Force Research Laboratory, DARPA, and Pratt & Whitney Rocketdyne. And this thing, they built four of these, and they are carried aloft on a B-52, released at altitude, and then a rocket motor fires to bring these things up to speed, and then the scramjet takes over, pushing this thing to, well, faster than Mach 5. And so they built four of these things. They've had some limited success or no success, or at least one case failure with the first three, but this one worked. And we've seen this thing shoot across the Pacific. It ran its full load of fuel. It runs JP7, which is, I think, the same fuel as the SR-71 Blackbird. Is that right, David? Isn't that the same fuel as the Blackbird ran?
It is.
And this is a scramjet. There's two things. There's ramjets and scramjets. And in both cases, there's kind of like no moving parts inside. He just uses the forward motion velocity of the aircraft in the engine to compress the air going into the inlet of the engine. So you don't have a compressor. And if you don't have a compressor, you don't need a turbine. In a ramjet, the combustion happens in air that's flowing subsonically. And in a scramjet, you have combustion in a supersonic airflow, which is what this X-51A has achieved. So pretty exciting, pretty fast little vehicle. David, this probably has more military application than anything else for quite a while.
Well, I think one of the things is they would like to develop a precision-guided munition, not a musician, precision-guided munition, or a PGM, that they could launch from the continental United States and take out a hostile radar installation or something very quickly without, like, launching into orbit. So, yeah, I think that's the practical application of this so far. But you never know. We might have Mach 5 transports. We were just talking about supersonic transports. Why not, you know?
Even
why
faster.
Not, yeah, why not New York to Japan in 2 hours?
We have a video that was sent to us by Jim Newcomb. He's the director of global brand management and advertising at the Boeing company. And a little video that sort of describes this X-51A Wave Rider. And I think they call it the Wave Rider because it actually uses lift, or it uses the shock wave from the vehicle to generate lift.
It is a lifting body. It's like the XB-70.
Ah, yes, right.
It surfs its own shock wave, causing it to lift. So aerodynamically, it's really a lifting body. The whole fuselage is the wing, not just, it's not a flying wing per se, but a flying fuselage.
All right, good. And we'll put a link to that video in the show notes. You can check that out. One final note on Boeing in the news this past week, just recently, is we saw that the Boeing board has authorized the company to offer the long-range 777X for sale. Now, it's not the same as authorizing development and production. That would happen later if the airlines expressed, you know, sufficient interest. But the board has to authorize the development and production. But this does let Boeing go out and start to sell this. And I think this move is really meant to counter the Airbus A350-1000, which I think BA just placed a large order for that plane. So Boeing has decided to jump into the fray. We'll probably hear a lot about this at the Paris Air Show, I would imagine. But so the first step in the so-called Boeing 777X has been taken. All right. Again, our guest is Arthur Rosen. He writes My Opinion, Thoughts, and Comments on General Aviation. Arthur, how long have you been writing that blog?
I'd say about 4 years now.
What spurred you to start writing that?
I used to, you know, you said Plane and Pilot News, who I wrote for until last month, and I found that aviation magazines don't really want to take a lot of controversial articles because they're dependent on advertising. And in aviation, the advertising world is a very small world, and they don't want to be insulted, even if they're wrong. So I just decided to stop writing for them last month and been writing my blog in adjacent to the newspaper articles and just enjoy it. And when something strikes me, I'll send off a blog.
And so that's great. I mean, you don't, you have complete creative control, right? You don't have someone looking over you, an editor or somebody directing you or influencing your writing.
Not at all. My wife loves it because he keeps me out of her way.
So what do you think are some of the recent big issues with aviation? Some of the ones maybe that you've covered in your blog or just others in general?
Well, the latest being Santa Monica, and I know y'all live on the wrong coast, but Santa Monica and Venice Beach are adjacent to each other and two of the most beautiful cities in the country with pristine beaches and dependent mainly on tourism and shopping. But the airport commission and city council over there marched to their own drummer. And Santa Monica is the only airport I know of in the country that charges a landing fee for small guys like me. I fly an old Bonanza, and they charge a landing fee. And the funniest thing is the landing fee for my airplane is $6.71, and it cost them over $20 to create that bill. And a friend of mine told me they'll bill you three times without any extra charges, so let it go to $60 before you pay the bill. But that's how messed up Santa Monica is. And just recently, last Wednesday, the city council voted to increase the landing fees 250% for everybody. Now, here's the most unusual thing of this increase. Is usually based aircraft at an airport do not have to pay landing fees. Well, the Santa Monica City Council said everybody's got to pay landing fees. So if you fly for the flight school at Santa Monica Airport and you do a touch and go, you're charged a landing fee every time you do a touch and go. Hmm. It's the problem is that residential development is the number one killer of airports. And over the years, I don't know if you know, Santa Monica was where the Douglas DC-3 was made. David could tell you a lot more about what was produced over there in early times. The airport's the oldest airport in L.A. Basin, started circa 1917. And they allowed houses to build right up to the edge of the airport.
Uh-huh.
And there is not, I've sat on two aviation commissions, and I'm just astounded that the only way you can sit on the Santa Monica Airport Aviation Commission is be anti-aviation. And usually these commissions could be an advisory panel to the city council so they can make good decisions about the airport, but it's the exact opposite in Santa Monica. So we've got a real problem now. The second part of the problem is they say they need to do this because they're not creating enough revenue for the airport to be self-sufficient. Well, AOPA came out with some facts that say they didn't include these fees and these fees and these fees, which would make them self-sufficient. And another thing Santa Monica doesn't do, which is one of the few airports in the United States, is they don't take any airport improvement grants from the FAA. Now, the way the regulations are set out, you cannot close an airport until that last grant runs a 20-year stretch. Well, Santa Monica is on the 17 of the 20 years, and I really and truthfully think, and I hate to say it, that that airport will go away in 3 years.
It's pressure from developers. Is that basically what's driving this? Because the land is worth so much more when it's developed?
They definitely want to develop the land. The pressure's there. Santa Monica, I mean, Santa Monica and Venice Beach marched, the people there marched to a little different music than the rest of the country. And, you know, they blame the lead emissions from the 100 low lead gasoline, but they don't say anything about the freeway that's right outside their house that's backed up for, you know, 15 out of 24 hours a day just blowing emissions out.
Yeah.
They don't say anything about the diesel tour buses that park in downtown Santa Monica with their engines running all day. So those people marched to a little bit of a different drummer. Now, they did leave an opening here. Santa Monica was sued by the FAA about 3.5 years ago for saying we're not going to allow any more D4 jets into Santa Monica, which is like a Gulfstream Series 5, 550, a Global 6000. They just said you can't come here anymore. So the FAA did sue Santa Monica, won the lawsuit, including millions of dollars of fees and costs. So now Santa Monica's left themselves open a little bit because the reason the city council gave for doing these new landing fees is we're not self-sufficient. Well, if AOPA can substantiate their facts, then a lawsuit can come about on that basis that, yes, you are self-sufficient, so you increase the fees under false pretenses. And the second thing is they don't take any grants over there. If they took grants, they would have been self-sufficient 20 years ago and never worried about it, but they don't want to take any grants because they're reaching their 20-year period for the airport to be closed. Now, there's some very deep-pocketed movie stars and wealthy people at Santa Monica Airport that base their corporate jets there. So it's going to be interesting if these people get together and file a suit against this also. Hmm. But it's not a good thing for aviation.
Now, how about user fees in general? I mean, everybody in the industry is opposed to user fees, I think. So I assume you are as well.
Well, I have a couple of problems with users' fees. Let's just say they went through on the corporate aircraft at $100 each trip as recommended.
Yeah.
Well, by the time the government puts together a new bureaucracy to collect this $100 each trip, it's going to cost them more than the $100 that they were charging. The problem is that we have a system in place right now for fuel taxes on jet fuel and avgas that pay these fees that keep the system going. There's no collection to be made by the federal government. They don't have to create another bureaucracy. And the general aviation alphabets out there all agreed, okay, we'll pay a couple of cents more in our aviation fuel taxes, and you don't have to create a new bureaucracy. But if you see what users' fees have done over in Europe, it's just destroyed all types of aviation. I know I've flown up to Canada before and had to pay a quarterly fee and was not aware that the quarter was coming to an end the day after we left. So you get hit for two quarters because you overlapped the second quarter. User fees just is another thing, like residential encroachment, that does destroy aviation.
You know, Arthur, we talk about the declining number of pilots. And we try to think of ways, and we talk about ways to get more people interested in flying, as well as just in aviation in general. But do you have any suggestions or ways that you think would be really productive to try to get more people involved in learning to fly?
Well, I'm going to challenge you on one statement that you said. The interest is there. People okay. would love to be able to fly, but today's economy is different than when I grew up. And yes, I'm a lot older than you, Rob, but when I grew up, the husband worked, the wife stayed at home, and seemed to get by. But now, with young people coming out of college, they're all coming out with tremendous loans. They got to have an apartment. They got to have a car. They got to pay their insurance. And so they have financial obligations that does not leave them the discretionary income to get into aviation. And the people that I see are getting into aviation is one class that Rob mentioned earlier, older people who their kids are moved on and having their own families and maybe saved enough in retirement and want to fly their whole life, and they're 55 years old and they're going to take flying lessons. Now, the problem is when they were younger, 20, 30 years ago, it would be under $2,000 to get a private ticket. Hmm. Now it's over, it's about $15,000 to get a private ticket. So it's a lot of discretionary income, and costs are up tremendously. I hate to be a fatalist, but I honestly see the small personal aviation going away in 5 to 10 years, except for the wealthy. So the people that can afford to buy the $600,000 Cirruses and those type of airplanes, they're still going to be flying. But the population is dying out. They're losing their medicals. They're tired of the expenses. And I think on a small basis, small plane basis, that's going to go away. On a large plane basis for the airlines, I don't think there's an imminent pilot shortage. Go several different directions here. Now to serve in the Air Force, you have to sign a 10-year commitment. So you're 20 years old, you're in there 30, and you re-up again to age 40, 42, and you got your pension in with the Air Force. And now with the age 65 rule, you can go directly and fly for the airlines, and you have all their qualifications met. Just have to get your type rating in that airplane. As far as I've heard some discussion that they were requesting now the age be raised from 65 for retirement to 67. And the other thing that you're going to see even more in the future, even though a lot of it is here now, is I think if there is a pilot shortage, that the airlines are going to request single pilot. They're going to say, hey, we're automated enough. We can fly domestically with single pilot. We can fly on two pilots. And they'll
we can even fly from the back seat.
That's right. We can fly with no pilots in some, in yeah, some cases,
true.
Right?
You can fly with two flight attendants up in the front seat.
That's right.
So, and then the third part of this, there's so many pilots that are out on furlough right now that I don't know how many of them have actually made a career where they could afford to live on their new career or would come back and fly, but there's an awful lot of pilots out there on furlough. So with the raising the age limit to 65, even though I know a lot of people are getting ready to hit retirement, I just don't think there's a pilot shortage in the airlines. And then you move over to business aviation, and when the airline pilots retire at 65, they usually go fly corporate for business aviation. So I just don't see an imminent pilot shortage. I've heard about it for years, but I still think it's way down the line. But I think it will be here one day, but not as imminent as other people think.
Well, finally, something we can disagree on, Arthur.
I read your comment.
I mean, in one part, well, let me just support you on one piece. I don't think that the Uniteds or the Deltas or the Southwests are ever going to go hungry for bodies. I just don't see it happening. But the regional airlines, especially with what it cost most of them to bring all these pilots up to the new 1500-hour ATP standard that goes into effect in August, that's going to be tough. And when the majors start expanding and they start sucking the pilots out of the regionals, it's going to be darn tough to find people that already have 1500 hours that are going to be able to fill those gaps, because that's the downside of the piece that Arthur mentioned earlier, is that it is so expensive to learn that a lot of people that would have done it are just saying, nah, I think I'll just take a pass on it. So it's going to, you know, we're going to get along for a while, but there's going to be a whole big sucking sound here, I think, eventually. But, you know, and I can't necessarily disagree with the part about the pilots retiring at 65. Most of the guys that I've known that made it to 65 with the airline said, man, I don't want to do it anymore. So maybe they can. But of course, then too, business aviation tends not to really like airline pilots in the cockpit the way they like people that came up the the route in aviation in another form. And that's just because a business aviation he's got to do the weight and balance. He's got to do the fuel. He's got to check the weather. He's got to file flight plans. He's got to be nice to the customers and get the bags loaded. And usually there's two of them. But you know, airline pilots, they don't have to do that stuff. They've got dispatchers and loaders and mechanics. And so, you know, especially when they're 65, you might get a few, but I'll bet you there's not going to be too many they're going to want to do all that work.
Well, let me ask you guys this. Wasn't the light sport aircraft category supposed to address some of these issues with the cost of entry into flying?
I think it was. I just have not really seen many of them. Do you have any at your airport, Arthur?
No, the problem is with light sport aircraft, they were supposed to be like a $60,000, $70,000 airplane. And they're $150,000 airplanes, and you're getting nothing for that price. You're not getting to go anywhere, go fast airplane. And you can buy a used Cirrus for $150,000. It's a quality airplane that'll take you cross country.
So in that regard, then, the LSAs haven't really lived up to the promise.
I don't know.
I don't think so either. I mean, there are some out there. I mean, we have our Skyer over at Flight Club. Flying Club is a former LSA that was eventually certified as a standard category airplane, but it's the same, essentially the same body, and we rent it out pretty cheap. I think it's $110 an hour, but a brand new one it's pretty expensive. It's probably $100,000, and again, who wants to spend that kind of money to fly at 90 knots? You might as well go buy as Arthur said, you could buy a used Cirrus. You could go buy a used 172 for $40,000 and do an awful lot of your training in that, and that's one way to do it. But again, I haven't really seen a whole lot of people being that enthused about this, at least enough to say, hey, why don't the three of us all do this and go in on an airplane together and make this work? And we did that 20, 30 years ago, but I don't see a lot of that happening anymore.
The only plane in that category that looks like it might be a true success story is the Icon, which is an amphibious plane that's still in production and still 250 pounds over the weight limit for an LSA. So they're waiting for a waiver from the FAA right now.
And that's going to be what? Is that 150? No, I think that's 175,000, isn't it?
No, that's 139,000
today.
Okay. Yeah. And it's really made to be safe. The plane won't spin, is their statement. And they're real big believers in safety. And the plane's a pretty cool plane. But again, you're not going to go anywhere, and you're not going to do anything, and you're not going to carry any luggage. And so it's a toy.
Arthur, are you having any experience with some of the newer technology? I'm thinking of tablets and iPads and apps that run on that are of value for pilots. Have you had any experience with any of those things yet?
Very much so, and I was probably one of the first people involved and tested this stuff out when I was writing for the magazine. But I'd like to go back one step before that.
Oh, sure.
And I have a problem with the FAA and legacy aircraft. Now, legacy aircraft are older Bonanzas, older Cessnas, piston aircraft. And the FAA wants you to put TSO equipment on there that costs probably three to four times what's available in the experimental market.
So for our listeners that may not be aware of the terminology, we're talking, we say TSO at time since overhaul. So
No, we're talking about technical service order.
Oh, okay.
When this equipment's been certified, and I apologize, there's so many acronyms in aviation that sometimes you forget your audience. But it's actually equipment that's been certified to go on a registered non-experimental airplane. Now, the cost of this equipment is relatively two to three times the cost for equipment that'll go on an experimental aircraft, a home-built aircraft. And the products that are out there now have been tested. They work. They've been in use for a long time. And again, it's safety, because if you can have this autopilot for $3,000 on your old Cessna instead of paying $15,000 for a TSO dollar pilot, it's a matter of safety. But the FAA won't allow that. And now I can go back and answer your questions. That's just one of my pet peeves, that non-TSO equipment can't go on legacy aircraft. So you see all the glass cockpits and everything on the Cirruses and the different airplanes out there, the Saratogas now, but you can't put some of this stuff on a registered certified aircraft.
Interesting.
As far as the iPad and the apps, the iPad is a godsend to me. I've been flying a lot of years. I flew with the very first GPS, portable GPS, which didn't even have an aviation database in it. It had no database. You'd put in all your own latitudes and longitudes for your own waypoints. And things have come so far so fast, it's amazing. As far as the apps go for the iPad, there's really, as far as I'm concerned, only two people in the business that own that business, and that's 4Flight and WingX. Both of them have advanced over the others over the past 4 years. Then the other would advance, the other would advance. The biggest thing is 4Flight seems to have a little more quality control than WingX. They never let anything out for an update that doesn't work right out of the box, where with WingX, you do an update and you don't know if it's going to work or not. But they're both excellent, excellent programs. And in addition to having, this lets you have IFR charts, VFR charts. It lets you have approach plates, and all these show referencing, where geo-referencing, which means where your airplane is on the chart, which is really nice for situational awareness. On top of that, for another $500 to $900, you can get a portable ADS-B unit that allows you to receive free weather now from the government. So the iPads, for a guy like me that has nothing but steam gauges, VORs, they are just really a lifesaver to fly with, and you feel much more comfortable. They're not IFR certified, instrument flight rule certified, but they are an asset to checking, backing up your other instruments to make sure you are where you think you are.
You know, it's interesting. Sometimes people who've been, well, to say around for a long time, have some difficulty accepting and understanding sometimes some of the newer technology. But I have to say, that doesn't seem to be the case here at all.
You're 100% correct on that. And the FAA is, they have a FAST program. I don't know if y'all are familiar with that. It's FAST. That's come from the FAA, and they have classes that meet in different cities and different parts of the state that go around and teach how to use the iPad, and they'll have one guy that's real knowledgeable teaching 4Flight, another guy teaching WingX, another guy teaching Garmin, but you bring your own iPad. It's not teaching you how to, you know, you have to know how to use the iPad. And it'll just show you some of the secrets to using these aviation apps, which are outstanding. But the older guys have caught on pretty good, and there's been another tremendous influx since the iPad Mini has come out.
Because the form factor is a little bit more conducive to in-flight use?
Exactly. You're 100% correct. I'm lucky that I have a yoke arm on my Bonanza, so I can mount my larger iPad where it won't interfere with the instruments. But with the new iPad, you can put it right between the yoke arms. And I know a lot of small guys use it, and a lot of corporate aviation departments use it also.
Rob, are you using the iPad or something similar to that in any of the flying that you do?
You know what? I've got, I managed to snag my wife's iPad 3, and I actually try it, but I don't use it as much as some of the guys in the club do, and but I think I'm probably a little odd in that sense. Well, I know David would say I'm probably odd in a lot of ways, but I just wanted to save him that trouble.
See, that's what I really like. You get to the point.
I ask and answer the questions, right? But you know what? I'm concerned about the fact that these things are really distracting, And, you know, especially when we're teaching in glass airplanes to start with, and then the guy brings an iPad in to do more stuff with it. And, geez, I don't know. I'm a little concerned about that. So, I'm probably not the average user, I'd say.
Well, I want to agree with Rob 100%. Not only the iPad, but the glass cockpit's my main concern, that people are flying with their heads down. And I've got a friend of mine that has a fairly new aircraft with a Garmin G1000 with three panels, and I have to keep telling him to get his head out of the cockpit and look outside the window. But on the other side, I would like to say one more thing. I've been flying for a long time, and I've never flown VFR from Santa Monica through the LFA Basin back to Scottsdale. And the reason why is there's just so much Class Bravo airspace, Class Charlie airspace, Class Delta airspace, and it's hard. You can't do it with a chart. You just can't fly through it with a chart. But with the iPad, you can plan a route and plan your altitudes and know how to get under the Bravo, around a Charlie, over a Delta, and follow your progress on the iPad, still keeping your eyes out of the cockpit. And I just think it's, since the invention of GPS, it's the greatest invention for aviation.
Very good. All right, Arthur, can you tell our listeners where they can find your blog?
My blog is aviation-myopinion.blogspot.com.
Very good. Now, are you on Twitter or anything else, or do you just pretty much hang out at your blog?
I'm on Twitter a lot, and it's Judge613.
Very good. All right. Anything else that you want to mention before we move along to the next segment?
Yes, I do. I just want to thank you all for the work you do for aviation. It's absolutely phenomenal what you do, and I try to tell people about you that are interested in aviation, and they've started downloading your shows and really enjoy it. And I just want to thank you so much for what you're doing. And I know, you know, each of you are making six figures doing this, but unfortunately the decimal point starts in the beginning.
That's right.
But you
had to bring that part up, didn't you?
It really is appreciated, and I just want y'all to know that.
Oh, thank you. You're very kind, Arthur.
Yeah, that's really nice. We appreciate that, Arthur. Thank you.
All right. Again, Arthur's site is My Opinion, Thoughts and Comments on General Aviation. Check it out. It's a fantastic read. I want to thank you, Arthur, for coming on the show, and we've really enjoyed spending a few minutes talking with you.
Well, thank you so much, and y'all have a great evening now.
And now here's David Vanderhoof, our official Airplane Geeks historian, with the aircraft of the week.
Thank you, birthday boy.
Thanks, David.
The Airplane Geeks airplane of the week, the Volte V-54 or BT-13 or SNV-1 or the Valiant, or more appropriately, the Vibrator. The United States Army Air Corps in 1938 evaluated a basic trainer designed from Volte aircraft. The V-51, or BC-3 as it was designated, was considered by the U.S. Army Air Corps to be too complicated. It featured a retractable landing gear with variable pitch props. Volte went back to the drawing board. The result was a simpler aircraft, the V-54, which was given the U.S. Army Air Corps designation of BT-13, or Basic Trainer 13. The BT-13 would be the second aircraft a pilot would fly in the Army Air Corps. They would start out in a primary trainer. That could have been a PT-19 or a PT-13 cadet / steerman. Once they were able to solo, they would move into the BT-13. The Valiant, as it came to be known, would teach the fledgling aviator how to fly on instruments and learn basic aerobatics. Eventually, they would move to the AT-6 or advanced trainer to learn how to fight an aircraft. The BT-13 was a two-place twin-stick aircraft with a huge greenhouse canopy for both pilot and instructor. Some of the lines the BT-13 came from a very famous aircraft, the Hughes H-1 Racer. In fact, Richard Palmer was the designer of both aircraft. The two-speed Hamilton standard prop attached to the 450-horsepower Pratt & Whitney R985-25 was the original production aircraft, which the Army Air Corps ordered 300. The 450R985 was downgraded from the BC3's Pratt & Whitney R1340-45, which developed 600 horses. The other major change was the move from retractable landing gear to fixed conventional gear. The Army Air Corps felt it was one too many options for a new pilot to deal with. Also, the original landing gear had spats, or aerodynamic fairings, around the fixed gear. The first of the 300 order were accepted by the U.S. Army Air Corps in June of 1940. The next major Valiant variant was the BT-13A. Two major changes occurred. One was the uprated Pratt Whitney 985 AN1 Twin Wass Jr., which now had 2,300 RPMs versus 2,000 in the original 985. To streamline production, the landing gear became naked without the spats. Over 7,000 plus of this version was created during the United States during the war. During this time, the Navy took an interest in the Valiant. They would purchase 1,115 BT-13As and call them the SNV-1s, or Scout Trainer Vulti. They would be flown in a similar fashion as the BT-13. All naval aviators would transition to the SNJ for their carrier qualifications. The SNV would never receive a tailhook. Eventually, the electrical system for the BT-13As became upgraded from a 12-volt electrical system to a 24-volt. This change became the SNV-2, or BT-13Bs. 1,250 were built, with almost a 50-50 split between the Army Air Corps and the United States Navy. During the production of the BT-13As, there became a shortage of the Pratt & Whitney engines. The Twin Wasps were also being used in the Voigt Kingfisher and the Beech Model 18, which served in multiple roles as a trainer and transport during the war. The decision was made to use the 450-horsepower Wright 975 Whirlwind. 1,263 aircraft were produced in this version. The different engine airframe mount was given a different designation. It became the BT-15. The BT-13/15 served in 27 countries, mostly in Latin America. Vulti always named its aircraft starting with the letter V. The BT-13/15 was the Valiant. The P-66 was the Vanguard. The A-35 was the Vengeance. However, names are usually given by the crews that fly them and the crews that fix them. And eventually, the BT-13 became known as the Vibrator. Why? There are several theories, but one of them was it had a hand-cranked flaps, which caused the whole greenhouse canopy to shake. So that concludes our history segment on the BT-13. We're not going to run the randomizer today, but next week we'll do this month in history for May. And this is David M. Vanderhoof, your airplane geek, signing off. P.S. Fred, you owe me a flight.
All right. Thank you, David.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, 6th of May, 2013.
Well, g'day, folks, and welcome to the Australia Desk for episode 247. Well, Grant, interesting this week, we have to talk about defence because they've handed down a defence white paper this week. You know, I always find it interesting that they call it a white paper when it's probably volumes and volumes of fancy glossy brochures and booklets and binders, and, you know, they should call it a defence dead forest.
Actually, once they put the white paper over the hole in defence and then paint it, it's no longer white. So it is a rather interesting proposition that you've got there, mate.
Oh, there you go. Well, tell us about the white paper. Now, you know, the government puts one of these out periodically and talks about the things, you know, all the nice things they'd like to buy in the coming years. And interesting from an aviation standpoint, they do talk about lots of things, including maybe getting some new submarines for the Navy, a few fancy bits and pieces for the Army. But for the Air Force, they're talking about buying 12 EA-18 Growlers. And Grant, it looks like that they may be considering, instead of converting 12 of the 24 Super Hornets they've got into the growler spec, which we've talked about earlier in the year, maybe they won't do that now. Maybe they'll keep those ones as F models and buy 12 more growlers. You know, that'd be pretty cool if they did that.
Well, it's kind of interesting, mate, because those 12 aircraft are apparently already plumbed, ready to have the additional equipment and pods put on to become the growler. So that means they're either they're carrying excess weight or they've had a few other things removed so that they can be a growler, which means if you don't make them a growler, is that a bit of a waste, which would give us 12 normal supers, 12 hybrid supers, the F plus, and 12 Gs. So I'm wondering if they're going to actually turn around and buy a whole new 12 F normals and convert those F pluses to the Gs. So I want to see where the details are at with that, because the latter seems pretty good. The other, you know, it seems like you're just going to be stuck with these hybrid units in the middle. So it seems kind of odd if they go down that path.
Yeah, well, I mean, that makes sense too, which is precisely why they won't do it that way that you suggested, Grant. Of course, this is a government we're talking about. Any government True. Won't do things logically.
Well, I mean, let's face reality, mate. This current government, very likely to be out in September based on what everyone's talking about. If the current powers that be are no longer the powers that be and a new parliament is sworn in and we change leaders, then it's entirely possible this white paper may not survive intact.
Yeah, well, that's interesting. Although I would say that a lot of these programs are carried on over the term of several governments, you know, regardless of who they are. And I would point, of course, to the purchase of the Joint Strike Fighters, which were also mentioned here. They were actually ordered in the government prior to this one and will probably be delivered in the government after this one. But Grant, they were originally looking for 100 F-35 Strike Fighters. Now, there's some talk here in this white paper that they might be reducing that order now to 72.
Yeah, and then you read it another way and it sort of says, well, no, they're actually doing 100. So again, waiting to see what happens there. It may be that they're bringing on a few earlier. I think I need to do a little bit more research, perhaps, you know, spare some time to actually go through the whole PDF. But it does seem from the summaries that I've been seeing that there's a little bit of confusion out there whether they're going for the 100 or the 72. Eventually, the JSF is going to be a great aircraft, but I think it's designed to be used in conjunction with other aircraft, he says, looking at the F-22. Making it the only aircraft in the fleet, well, as everyone said, that's why we're getting the growlers, to plug some of the holes in the JSF's defenses and so on. I'm half and half on the JSF. I love new technology and love new aircraft, but I'm not sure that a JSF on its own is really the solution we need.
Well, Lockheed Martin certainly seem you know, very positive about it all. In fact, they put out a statement this week in response to the white paper that said, amongst many other things, that it was honoured by the trust and confidence shown by the Australian government. And the statement says here, along with the first two Australian jets in production, which they'll deliver by mid-2014, we will work closely with the government to support their purchase of their remaining 100 F-35 aircraft. So maybe wishful thinking. You know, at one point I was thinking they might only order 50 based on some of the reports that I've read. So, well, if we get 72, that's a pretty sizable fleet for an Air Force the size of the Royal Australian Air Force. Let's face it, it's not a huge one. So, you know, let's see where that goes. But yeah, interesting news this week. And boy,
yeah, definitely.
You talk about interesting news, Grant. If we were a maritime podcast, well, boy, talk about Australian submarines. That could keep us going for weeks.
Mate, there was quite a bit of maritime aspects to the white paper. Also included in there was a shift in the perception of China. In the previous 2009 paper under the Rudd Labor government, China was seen as a threat. However, now under this white paper released under the Julia Gillard Labor government, it's saying the government does not approach China as an adversary.
Well, I guess, Grant, that makes sense because our entire economy is being supported by the huge growth rates in China. So great guys, the Chinese. I love them. In fact, the company I work for is owned by the Chinese. So they can't be all that bad.
Yeah, slip that one through and let's get on with it then.
Let's get on with it. Well, speaking of politicians this week, Australia's Attorney General. Now, he's the most senior law official in this country, and his name is Mark Dreyfus. He's not very popular. In fact, he made quite a fool of himself this week on board a Qantas flight.
Yeah, we're all told, all of us humans are told, turn off your electronic device. Stop talking on the phone as soon as they close the door. You can get on board the plane talking, you can sit down on the plane talking, but once the door closes, before they push back, you've got to put them into flight mode and turn them all off. And yes, our wonderful Attorney General failed to turn his phone off. And when requested, he says he was he wasn't requested multiple times. The crew are saying he was. Basically, During the flight, they actually requested Australian Federal Police to meet the aircraft, but when they finally landed, no assistance from the AFP was required, and things had calmed down. Mm-hmm. But apparently he failed to comply with the directions of the crew. I'm not sure if he was actually continuing to talk on it during the flight or anything crazy like that. But, you know, if it had been one of us poor plebs, let's face facts, we would have been cuffed off and explaining to a judge just what we were thinking, wouldn't we?
Yes, yes. A pretty poor show there by Mark Dreyfus. He really ought to know better. In fact, any person of high office, regardless of their political affiliation, you know, they should think about that. They're in the public eye. It wouldn't even matter if they're politicians, for that matter. If they're in the public eye, they need to think about this. And I noticed that some of the reports there are begging people to send in videos of this. I don't know that any came, but
as usual with most newspapers these days, it's turning all the rest of us into their staff, but and asking us to pay for the articles. But anyhow, we won't go down that path today.
Listeners should know that Grant has been tormenting News Limited this week, demanding to know why they're putting advertising in things that we're paying for. But Grant, I don't think you had much luck there. I don't think you managed to turn them around, unfortunately.
Oh, not a chance of that. I got total boilerplate, but now I feel justified for putting ad blocker in. But anyhow,
there we go. Well, speaking of people that are going to turn things around, let's talk about the new boss of Tiger Airways. He's ex-Qantas. I think we mentioned that a few weeks ago in a report. Now Rob Sharp has taken the reins there at Tiger Airways, so let's see how that goes, eh?
Yeah, indeed. He's apparently got an extensive executive management career in aviation, according to some of the articles. He had a number of commercial roles at Qantas over the past 15 years, including in strategy, and is the head of the Global Airport Infrastructure and Services Group. You can tell I'm reading because that just rolled straight off my tongue. So now he's joining John Borghetti, yet another ex-Qantas executive coming across to help out John Borghetti, not so much with Virgin on this one, but with Tiger. So can he turn it around? Can he make it work? Borghetti is saying they're not going to change any of their existing route structure at this point. He's telling everyone, just don't worry, everything's not going to change overnight. It's all cool. We'll see what happens as they step forward. But he's got a lot of work ahead of him, I'd say.
Well, I think that's everything we have this week, Grant. Now, you know, actually this week I put up a photo of my studio because I'm very proud of my little studio here. But did you notice what Max referred to his studio as, Grant?
Yeah, I think he called it the Max Cave. I think that's pretty cool.
That doesn't sound very cool the way you said it there, though. I'd prefer to call it the Max Cave. Yes.
Wow.
I tell you what, Max, we need photos of the Max Cave. I'd like to see them in the show notes this week.
But with or without the bats and the funky Batmobile in the background?
Oh, no. If he's got a Batmobile, that'd be even more cool.
Okay. Well, I mean, that echo, it sounded like, wow, all you needed was the running water in the background, man.
So there we go, dubbing Max in and making more work for him. Until next week, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm Grant McCarran, and I'm definitely not wearing Speedos, even if I do manage to keep kilos out of the cockpit.
I've never worn a pair of Speedos in my life, Grant.
Yeah, and for which we are all eternally grateful.
Thank you very much.
Hey, with friends like me, who needs enemies?
Oh, gee, you knew Speedos was going to come up again.
Did he just say, with friends like me, who needs enemas?
What is that? No. Is that what he said? I'll have to listen again. Oh, yeah, this whole thing about the studios, there are a couple of Google Plus communities where a lot of podcasters hang out. And I think that's where, is that where Steve posted a picture? Or maybe it was Facebook. I don't recall. But in any event, I kind of countered with a description of mine to try to out-geek Steve Vischer. And so he's demanding proof now by way of a photograph. But that's, it's hard to, I can't get back far enough to sort of take in the whole thing because there's stuff behind where I stand right now. But I'll see if I can somehow put together a photo, and we'll see who's got the geekier setup.
I have a tail hook.
How is that tail hook displayed, David? Is it hanging or just leaning against a wall, or how have you got that?
Right now it's leaning up against the wall.
Okay. How big is this thing?
It's about 6 feet long.
Huh. All right. It's not too big. All right. Well, I don't know what the transition is, but here's Peter Johnson across the pond.
So we're back in the historic flight hangar, and I'm with Lieutenant Commander Ian Sloan. Lieutenant Commander, the last time I was here before Christmas, aircraft were being stripped down. There were lots of bits and pieces all over the place. Where are we now?
Well, Peter, you made that point very well. The pre-season getting the aircraft ready really does start. Yeah. At the end of the previous season, and we have to take a view on when we need to stop flying. Yeah. In order to carry out the required servicing on the aircraft, and of course any modification or any routine servicing over and above. Yeah. what we'd expect. So as you said, Peter, back in October, that was when everything was being taken apart. We like to think that now we're in April, things are going back together again.
Yeah.
And you can see some pretty complete aircraft around here.
Yeah.
And again, we focus on the aircraft that we know we want to be flying straight off the bat.
Yeah.
Now, this year, for example, we've got a very big push for the Battle of the Atlantic 70th yep. anniversary celebrations or commemorations, which will take us over London and Liverpool during May.
Yeah.
So really, it's full steam ahead to get the Swordfish going where we can.
Yeah. Okay, and you've got two Swordfish here. What's the status of the second aircraft?
Well, the second aircraft right now is, we've got the wings back with us. They were painted at the start of this year. The fuselage is about to go back into the paint shop to be completed. When that's back, we'll be building the aircraft up.
Yeah.
On top of that, and in fact in parallel with that, the engine is being manufactured off-site by a company down in Waterlooville near Portsmouth.
Yeah.
Who are specialists in vintage engines. And that will all fall into place, hopefully, at about the same time.
And is that aircraft due to fly this year?
We certainly hope to fly that aircraft this year. It's not going to be coming out the shed straight away, as you can see. It's still a very bare aircraft, but we certainly hope to see that aircraft flying. Now, personal objectives would be the Overton Air Day would be a nice yeah. launch show for that aircraft. Any one of the Navy shows would be ideal, frankly.
Yeah. Okay. So the plan is to have potentially two Swordfish in the air. What other aircraft are we going to see this year from the historic flight?
Well, as with last year, we'll have the Sea Fury accompanying the Swordfish. We finished last season with a single Sea Fury and a single Swordfish.
Yeah.
The plan this year is to culminate with doubling our money effectively with yep. two Sea Furies and two Swordfish.
Right.
And that will be the trick to get the second Sea Fury yeah. up and running this year as well.
Right, okay. And the aircraft are in various states of assembly at the moment. Where are you at the moment in terms of preparing the air crew and the ground crew in terms of the display season?
We're quite a long way along that road now, actually, Peter. Mm. At the start of March, we had our pilot's trap ride, so we had yep. Naval Flying Standards Flight visit us to make sure that all our procedures are as they should be.
Yep.
We are certainly well on the way with the pilot workup as well. We've held our annual training week where we get the pilots flying anything that yeah. has got a set of wings, frankly, mm-hmm. Make sure that their skill sets are getting back to where they should be.
Yeah.
So in the last month, all our pilots have flown the Chipmunk, they've flown the Piston Provost,
yeah.
and they've flown the Harvard as well.
Right. Okay.
In preparation for getting back into the aircraft. Yeah. And for two of our pilots, it will be a question of getting back in the saddle, as we say.
Yeah.
For a third, it will be converting into the Swordfish for the first time.
Right, okay. And are you planning to fly any of the shows this year?
Actually, I'm on my way out of the flight, in very short order, I dare say, and I'll be hanging up my flying boots at Yeovilton in May, at the start of May, to take up another job, which I'm doing a bit of language training for that, which is good for me.
Okay, but still with the Navy?
Still with the Royal Navy, yes. Actually, I'm going to be on exchange with the French Navy, which is very exciting for me.
Right, okay. And are we allowed to ask what will be involved with that? Are you going to fly any different aircraft?
Well, it will be flying the Super Etendard from French carriers, yeah. which is really great for me and my development as a carrier pilot, and with Queen Elizabeth class
yeah.
Entering service in the next 5 years.
Yeah.
That's just the kind of skill set I'll need to keep my flying going.
Right, I understand, because of course we've lost the Harrier, so we've lost our vertical takeoff and our carrier capability, so training with another Navy makes a lot of sense.
Absolutely, absolutely, and the Royal Navy have a number of agreements with the US Navy, for example, the US Marines as well,
yeah.
And the French Navy is another string to our bow, really. All very relevant flying, and of course we have a number of agreements with those nations in any case, so it's strengthening those bonds that we have with those countries.
Okay, coming back to this historic flight before we sign off then, I'm very excited about that news, it sounds very exciting. So how's the season panning out in terms of bookings and the programme for this year?
Well, the programme for this year really, for us, is centering around the Battle of the Atlantic celebrations. That is the big Navy-led celebration that we are focusing on. Aside from that, it's like any other season, frankly, and we'll sit down during January and have a conference with the various platforms across the Royal Navy at what we call the display allocation meeting, where we will get a feel for what shows want us to display.
Yeah.
And of course, that's an opportunity to, for us to feed in as well, that we'd particularly like to display at various shows as well.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, you'll have spoken today to Katie Campbell as our display manager. This is a time when she's very busy just ironing out all the little wrinkles in the year and sorting out each weekend's trade for us, really.
Yeah.
And so we can get to pick and choose our best destinations. We then divvy that up amongst the pilots. And the beauty of having two pilots per aircraft, which is our typical loading, is that we can generally filter out the shows to the guys that want to do them. Mm. It's very handy that way.
Well, Lieutenant Commander Sloan, thank you very much for having us. And we'd like to particularly thank Katie for all the work she's done in supporting this mini-series.
Yeah, that's quite all right, Peter. Thank you.
This is Peter Johnson, reporting for the Airplane Geeks from across the pond.
Boy, did that guy sound like a Navy pilot or what?
Yeah, great, huh? I love that. Peter's had some great interviews. He's got quite a collection of fascinating aviators and folks in aviation that he's been talking to. I know he's got a lot coming up as well. So that's
where does he get all these people? Does he hang out outside the gate of these, naval stations? Or
I don't know. I don't know. But he's doing a great job at it. That's for sure.
I hope he stays in touch. It would be interesting to find out what it was like to cross deck and learn to fly the Intendard.
Yes, huh? Yeah.
I don't know if I could learn a language to learn to fly in another language. Rob, how fluent are you in your French Canadian?
Oui.
There it is. There it is.
Bonsoir. Au revoir.
But
okay, that's it.
Croissant.
We're going to get mail on that one. All right, let's
escargot.
Let's move on to listener mail before we get into any more trouble. We heard from Grant McHaren. He wrote us a fantastic email, a long email, too long to go over in its entirety here. But he did talk about a number of topics. First one, sequestration, which he says is American for austerity. He says the ATC delays were like the cancellation of the demo teams, something very public that will impact elected officials directly or have their constituents so pissed off they actually get up and complain. He says it sucks that our favorite things, flying, demo teams, etc., are being used as a political tool, but that seems to be the way of modern Western politics. Grant also comments on seat pitch. He says he votes with his wallet. Says if it's more than 2 hours long, I pay extra to get space, either by avoiding airlines with tight seats or by paying to get up front where there's more space. Says the next step is to start telling the airlines that I'm doing this by emailing their PR and customer service folks to say, I flew with you because, or I didn't fly with you because. And Grant also talks about in-flight entertainment. He says my favorite form of IFE is in-seat power. He says most airlines don't have what I want to watch or read or listen to, but I know I'm in the minority when I say all I use it for is watching the flight progress map. As to connectivity, I still kind of like being able to say, sorry, I'm offline for a few hours. And on the 787, he says I'm an airplane geek and love the old Boeing, not the new McDonnell Douglas Mark II that they have become. He says, I will not fly the 787 for at least another year for the same reason I held off flying the A380 for at least a year. I want to let the bugs become apparent in the system. He says, honestly, the 787 is to me, like the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter, roughly the same as version one of any Microsoft software. I don't trust it yet, and I want to see a few, quote, service packs and upgrades to come out to fix things. He says, I would not put my family on a 787, as I think Boeing are no longer an engineering company. They're now run by short-sighted, bonus-chasing middle managers. Uh-oh. My friends at Boeing are gonna jump up at that, I'm sure.
I'm still reeling from the McDonnell Douglas Mark II comment. I'm not quite sure what he had against McDonnell Douglas. I don't know. It's just one of those. It's sort of like, okay, there was really nothing wrong with DC-9, Skyhawks, Phantoms, Eagles, any of the other products, the C-17. That he's so fond of. I want a further explanation on that there, Grant.
Grant had some other comments. Well, I should say rants about these topics. It's actually pretty good. Grant had some great points. But Mary Kirby did respond to his email because she saw it as well. And Mary says, I urge anyone who feels strongly about the ultra-tight seating situation to express their views on social media and use the passenger experience hashtag, which is PAXEX, okay, passenger experience. She says, we'll need a chorus of voices to invoke change. So thanks to Mary for kicking that in as well. We also heard from Michael, who says, I'd love to hear David's views on this. He says, the Associated Press tweeted Navy unveils squadron including both manned and unmanned aircraft. I know, David, did you have a chance to look at that?
A helicopter, medium strike squadron 35, HMS 35, is now going to have 10 RQ-8 Firebees and MH-60 Romeos. And they're going to support the LCSs, which are littoral combat ships, which are our new fleet of ships that are designed to fight inland, in uprivers, close in. They're not large capital ships; they're smaller ships.
Hmm.
The RQ-8s have been working off them last couple of years in things like drug interdiction and Homeland Security and such. I think this is a good idea. I mean, you're cross training pilots to the Romeos and to the drones, and a good helicopter pilot in real life would probably make a really good helicopter drone pilot.
Hmm.
So I don't see where this is really such a radical idea. Pilots have been flying drones for years. It's just one squadron has got two different types of aircraft. Okay, one might not have a man in it, but it's a looks like a helicopter. It beats the ground in submission, so it flies like the Romeo. It's a interesting experiment, but I don't really think it's that novel, and it makes a lot of sense.
So this is a situation where they use kind of take the best features or characteristics of either type of aircraft and apply them, in a combined way to achieve the best possible result.
The drone pilots can support the helo pilots, and the helo pilots can support the drones. And the Navy's been doing this kind of thing for years. If you stay long enough in a squadron, you have to become the landing signal officer for a cruise, where your job is to rate all the pilots and you are a communication tool. So if you're introducing drones to the fleet, and who better than the helicopter pilots who actively work in the fleet to bring the drones into the fleet? So it's a good idea.
Yeah, great. Okay. We also heard from Adam. Adam says, thought you guys might be interested in the attached article detailing the large orders of new aircraft by this up-and-coming Norwegian carrier. And this is Norwegian Air Shuttle. He says, it's interesting to note they have expansionist plans similar to others that have previously been in the news with large new aircraft orders. He says, I wonder if the international airline industry is setting itself up for a capacity glut with such large purchases, or whether they are expecting a prolonged period of growth in international passengers and are gearing up with capacity in advance. And he included a little extract from Wikipedia that shows aircraft, including orders for Norwegian Air Shuttle. And the numbers are pretty big. In service, they have 74 aircraft, which are mostly Boeing 737-800s, a few -300s, and that's pretty much it. For orders, they've got 245 orders. That includes 100 A320neos, 100 737 MAX airplanes, some more 737-800s, and even 8 787-8s. That's 245 orders. And they have options for 152 more. Huge growth. And, you know, we see these giant orders fairly frequently. It's an interesting question that Adam asks about the you know, the worldwide capacity, if everybody is out ordering these large numbers of primarily narrow-body aircraft, are we going to see too much capacity? And I don't know. It's kind of hard to tell. You know, if you polish up the crystal ball, both Boeing and Airbus have been predicting huge numbers of narrow-body aircraft in demand. And I guess the airlines are kind of stepping up to meet that forecast. But hey, it's a forecast. I mean, sometimes forecasts are accurate and sometimes they're not. Certainly, there's a lot of dollars riding on these forecasts.
Well, and I think one thing that we don't know for certain is how many of those airplanes are destined just to replace current airplanes. Current aircraft, I should say.
Sure, yeah.
Because the, you know, the age of the retired aircraft has been dropping quite a bit in the last 5 years alone. I mean, aircraft that would have still been flying years and years ago are already being scrapped for parts. So I guess that's it's hard to believe that any of the airlines could get into another overcapacity problem as they've done in cycle and cycle and cycle again. You'd think by now they learned. So I'm hoping that's the case, at least.
Sure. Yeah. You know, it reminds me of what you said, Rob, about some years ago, how the 727s were being retired right and left because a lot of different reasons. But, you know, those aircraft were getting pretty old, and the newer aircraft, the twins, the 737s and the A320 family airplanes were much more efficient and had better business cases for the airlines. We're kind of seeing that now with the A320neos and the 737 MAX that offer significantly better, you know, fuel economy, and that just accelerates the, you know, retirement of the older planes. You know, it's funny to call them older though, because they don't feel that old, you know.
But then again, those McDonnell Douglas MD-80s keep outlasting all those Boeing products, aren't they?
Grant should should take notice of that, right?
Maybe.
Yeah.
I'll miss them when they're gone, because they do still sound like a pair of Skyhawks taking off.
Okay. I think we have time just for one more email. This is from Yong Lim Fu, and we've heard from him in the past. And from Singapore, as I recall. I hope I've got that right. He's got a YouTube video that he put out. He said, I was thinking if it is possible if we can spread the spirit of aviation through your Aviation Geeks podcast. So he's put together a little video on YouTube, and we'll put a link to that in the show notes, along with all the other sites that we've mentioned this episode. Okay, once again, I think that's going to do it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast. We want to thank our guest, Arthur Rosen, a fantastic guy, interesting guy who's been around aviation for a long time in a lot of different capacities and has a lot of interesting opinions.
And finally, somebody older than me.
And someone finally older than Rob. We believe. You guys can arm wrestle that out offline. Arthur's got a blog that you'll want to check out. It's called My Opinion, Thoughts and Comments on General Aviation. And you can find that blog at aviation-my... You know, I say dash. Everybody else seems to say hyphen. Maybe I'll switch. aviation-myopinion.blogspot.com. And you can also follow him on Twitter, where he's Judge613. We also want to thank our contributors, Steve Vischer and Grant McCarron. Find them at plaincrazydownunder.com. And also Peter Johnson, who you can find at aviation-extended.co.uk with no leading E on extended. All right, let's tell our listeners where they can find us online. And David Vanderhoof, we will start with you.
You can find me on my blog at whatjustflewby.com, or you can find me lurking on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof, or you can check out some of the airports we play with, which is Addison Airport, which is Facebook.Addison or Facebook.Whitman. And we're getting close, folks. We're coming up on Osh 13.
That's right. I understand Chicago is going to be the featured band this year. That's pretty exciting, huh? And also Jetman is going to be there. You know Jetman, right? Yeah, that guy.
Yeah, they said he's not going to go below 1,000 feet, though, so I don't know how we're going to see him.
Is that right? He's going to be above 1,000?
Well, that's what they said.
All right. Well, it ought to be pretty exciting in any event. All right. Let's see. Where are we? Rob Mark, where do folks find you online?
Well, they find us at jetwine.com, where I'd very much like to hear listeners' opinions about the ethical or philosophical side of this crazy Air India pilot thing. I'm already getting beaten up even as we speak tonight for including the flight attendants in my comments story I wrote. Uh-oh. But I can't help it. They were there. They didn't do anything either. But I do think it's an interesting story. So you can find us at jetwine.com, Jetwine on Twitter, and who knows where on Facebook and all that. And we're on LinkedIn, too. I don't know. We never talk about LinkedIn, do we?
No, not too much.
Yeah. No. Well, I'm up.
Are you on LinkedIn?
Too.
Yeah, you're on LinkedIn. I'm in LinkedIn, too.
So am I.
All right.
So we're all linked in.
So we're all linked in together, and folks can find us there. And otherwise, you can find me, Max Flight, on Google Plus and Twitter. Just look for Max Flight. Also, you can see my aviation directory at 30,000feet.com. You can find show notes for this episode at airplanegeeks.com. This is episode 247. And you'll find links there to all the sites that we mention on the podcast, the articles that we talk about in the news segment, some photos, and other great stuff. Be sure to follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Google+. Just look for Airplane Geeks. And we're also on Stitcher.com. You can stream us right to your mobile phone or other device, if you like, through Stitcher.com. If you want to send us an email, that address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And we also have a listener line where you can leave us an audio message. Aunt Benet, what's the number?
And if you want to call the Airplane Geeks, you can dial 361-GEEKS01.
I wonder how Benet's flight training is coming along. Rob, have you heard anything, or David, any updates?
No, actually, I haven't. I have talked to her this week. I'll have to ask her.
Ask her for sure. All right. Opening and closing music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. So join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Thanks for listening.
Good night, everybody. Thanks for being a part of our show.
Thanks, Arthur. Hey, that was really good. That was really interesting. You were a fantastic guest.
I thought I'd bore the hell out of your people that listen.
I don't think so.
I don't know. I'd say the jury's still out on this.
Oh, here we
go. Doom.
We are live. Let's do it.
All right, here we go. Bring that down, move that across there, drop that bit down here and click this on and, ooh, a space cannon. Obligatory had to be done.
Oh, yes.
Right, 3, 2, 1. Dateline, 6th of May, 2013.
Well, g'day, folks, and welcome.
I don't know, man. I've heard the stories. You last time you wore a pair, everyone thought you were the Hoff.
Yeah, well, he is. He's not looking as fit as he used to. That's all I'll say about the Hoff. Yes, well, you know, yes. Well, now,
let's just kill that whole line.
let's take it from the top, shall we? Well, that makes a good outtake.
But in terms of the season, how was the season panning out in terms of bookings?
Well, we're
that'll be too much. I'll ask that question again, but it's always nice background noise. Yeah.